You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast, where we talk about technology that can serve the church and its work of spreading the gospel. Wells Tech is a part of the podcast network on Streams, the internet media site sponsored by the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Join the conversation by visiting our podcast website at wellstech.wells.net. Today is Wednesday, January 23rd, 2008, and welcome to Episode 3 of the Wells Tech Podcast. I'm Martin Spriggs.
And I'm Sally Draper.
And we are your hosts for this half hour of Tech Talk in Ministry. Sally, how are you?
I'm good. Now that I survived the big snowstorm, I've been traveling through southeastern Wisconsin in about a foot of snow, so it was quite a challenge.
Yeah, I didn't think we were going to be able to pull things off today. We had some challenges trying to hook up this morning, which we kind of abandoned because of inconsistent connections at the hotel and all kinds of things. Murphy's Law was was rearing its ugly head in all its glory, and usually at the worst times, just when you need technology to actually work. So, but we are doing our third show, and I suppose you couldn't call us veterans yet. I still feel like a rookie. Or maybe to use a computer term, newbie, right?
That's right. Still have lots to learn, and we appreciate all the feedback we get.
And if you would like to participate in the show or help us make it better, there are a number of opportunities for you to do that and a number of ways to do that. First of all, the best way is to go to our website, wellstech.wells.net, and just read the information there. That's where you'll find all of our show notes and links about all the things that we've talked about on the show. And also a place for you to leave a comment. Also, there's a tab there that you can click on that will show you all the other ways to contact us. One of those ways is wellstech@wells.net. That's our email address. If you want to leave a voicemail and have that played on the air, that number is 414-375-2334. If you are familiar with the social bookmarking website called Delicious, that's del.icio.us, you can tag items of general interest that you'd want us to consider and talk about. Just use the tag WellsTech, WELSTECH. We're on Facebook. You can just do a search on the group WellsTech. And finally, you can participate in the WellsTech listserv, and you'll find that information about how to subscribe and the most recent comments made to that mailing list right on our WellsTech.Wells.net website. So lots of ways to get in touch with us.
We'll be sharing some of that feedback later in the show in our community feedback section.
Well, we're only in show 3, and we're already going to pitch our traditional format out the window, Sally. Normally, Sally and I have a tech chat followed by an interview and then some tech tidbits, and those three sections were in the first two shows. Well, in this third show, in an effort to bring our listeners the most relevant, hard-hitting, gripping, and can't-live-without content, we're going to go directly to our interview segment this afternoon. Joining us today is Wells Network Security Administrator, that's a pretty long title, Rob Benson. Thanks for being on the show, Rob.
Well, thank you.
As Sally and I were kind of putting our heads together determining what kind of topics would be of general interest to most of our listeners. One of those topics that came to mind was security. We recognize that a lot of our listeners are workers in church offices or schools, and a lot of the same concerns that a home user would have would apply to those users, because there's always, there's typically not a lot of security, a lot of, what we'll call firewalls or protection from the outside world in a lot of those places. And we thought it would be a great idea to have Rob on to talk to us a little bit about some of the things that you can do to protect yourself essentially from the outside world. Rob has spent how many years now in the Synod Administration Building, Rob?
Well, right around 3.
And he's seen probably many of the tricks and those kinds of things that the folks on the outside would love to do to get at some of the information on the inside, and we recognize that there is some valuable information sitting inside the computers and the networks of our church workers as well. So what are some, Rob, what are some of the common ways that bad people or you know, what we would call bad viruses can get into your computer?
There's really three big ways. Our pastors are trusting people, understandably. One of the major ways is misleading emails that have attachments in them, and they'll often appear to come from a friend or maybe a large company. You click a link or you open the attachment, and suddenly you're redirected, and a virus or some type of backdoor is installed on your system.
So sometimes the senders aren't even aware that they're carrying these viruses, right?
Oh, that's correct. Often they don't.
So it's just a germ that's infected them somehow, and they're just kind of passing it along unsuspectingly?
Yes, it works best if you don't notice it.
Right. And I assume that's what the bad guys are trying to do.
Yes.
They're trying to make it as real as possible, that this is something valuable that you should click on and open. What kind of bad things can those viruses do?
Well, often they'll open a back door to your system, which is basically a way for a third party to be able to access your computer and look at the data on it. Often they'll steal passwords. They'll get information about your login. Maybe check your session, see what email you're reading. I mean, you can harvest a lot of information off of somebody's computer, especially if they go to their banking sites.
Does it actually have to be something that's in a file on your computer, or do they really know what you're doing on your computer, the websites you're visiting, or maybe even the keystrokes that you're hitting?
Well, it depends on what type of software gets installed. There are keyloggers that can literally trace every keystroke you make, every letter you type. Some can actually give a visual representation of what you're seeing on the desktop, although those are in the extreme. Most will allow you to at least see files on your computer and download them.
Okay. You mentioned there were two other ways then?
Mm-hmm, sure. There's often pop-up ads on websites that you'll go to that will notify you that you have spyware, a virus, or some other type of security issue, and they'll prompt you to install some software to remove it. Unfortunately, the software that you install is spyware in itself. They really often attempt to look like a system error. Like it's actually coming from your computer. And those are some of the worst.
Okay.
Finally, if you do a lot of software copying, if you do software piracy, maybe share movies and share music, they're a constant source of viruses and backdoors and spyware as well.
So those are sites that you should probably be suspicious of in the first place. And to be able to protect yourself, the first line of defense is, be careful where you go.
Oh, yeah. Use common sense.
I have a couple of questions about some of the terms that I hear. Maybe you're talking about these and what you're describing, but I've heard of malware and phishing. Phishing spelled with a PH looks kind of funny, but are those some of the kind of things that you're describing, or are those something different?
Well, malware is any type of software that's designed to get into your computer or possibly damage it without your informed consent. It could say it's one type of program and then hide another program in it. Which basically opens a back door to your computer. Or it could be just something totally unrelated to what it said it was. It could have a different name to the file and just basically install a virus on your system. Oh, phishing. You asked about phishing,
right?
As well. Basically, phishing is an attempt to fraudulently acquire sensitive information, perhaps your username and your password, maybe some credit card details. By masquerading as a business or nonprofit or government agency. They generally do this through email. They'll act like maybe they're your PayPal account and you need to do a PayPal update. Generally, I don't give any account information through an email link.
And typically companies don't ask for that information either, right?
Yeah, they generally have it.
Interesting. So sounds like our defenses should be up. There's a lot of people that are interested in getting at our information, either on our personal computers or, like Martin said, in our church office settings or our school computer lab settings. Are there some good resources, particularly any free resources that you can recommend?
Well, sure. If you're a Windows user, there's AVG, which is free antivirus for Windows. There's also something called Avast, which is an antivirus product as well. Both of those come in pay-for and free versions, but if you are a home user or a single user, you can download those and use them for free.
How do those work, Rob?
Basically, you download them. They work like any other antivirus software. You install them. I believe that AVG Free now requires a registration where you give a little bit of personal information about it, which they guarantee they won't sell. So,
okay. Now, I know some computers come with like Symantec or Norton antivirus, those kinds of things. And, you know, maybe a free year's worth of what they call virus subscriptions.
Right.
What if, you know, you do the free thing for a year and then it seems to be working well and you say, well, you know, next year I'm just going to, you know, use what I've got. So I've already got it on my system. Is that really protecting you if you're not keeping up with a subscription for the service?
If it's not up to date, you're not protected at all.
Why is that?
Viruses come out every day. If you're running one-year-old virus antivirus software, you're basically not protecting your computer at all. It's much better to go to a freeware version or, you know, just chalk up the money and pay the $30 and get the update.
Okay. So it's probably a wise investment. And even for the free stuff, they're all drawing from kind of a large database of viruses that get updated. And your system is just staying smarter on top of the things that are going out there in the, you know, on the internet.
Exactly.
Okay. Does security software slow down your system or prevent you from doing some things? It seems like it can be, you know, it's got to be doing something in the background, checking your email or doing some things to do its job. Is it really kind of, you know, a drain on your system?
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, some of the best antivirus packages or the largest antivirus packages such as Norton or McAfee take up a pretty large chunk of system resources. They have a lot of files, a lot of services that run in the background on your computer, and that can slow down your computer quite a bit. Some of the freeware ones are actually lighter on your system. However, they're not as feature-rich, and they're probably not as friendly.
Attachments are a big thing these days. Email's become such a valuable tool to a lot of our churches and a lot of our schools. And the advent of broadband or high-speed connections allows you to send larger and larger attachments. You know, should you just avoid attachments altogether for fear that, you know, they contain a virus? Or, you know, how should you approach attachments?
Well, I'd use common sense. I mean, if you've never heard of somebody, if you don't recognize the email address that it's coming from, I wouldn't open any attachment from them. I would also take care if you're not expecting an attachment from a friend. There's many viruses that will literally send out email attachments from your computer with your name on it, and an unsuspecting friend will open it, and they'll be infected as well. Especially in business, it's really important to know who's sending what to you, and keep your mind on that.
So, what happens if we do end up with the dreaded virus on our computer? First of all, how will we even know, and what do we do if we do get a virus on our computer?
Well, excessive pop-ups during internet browsing are often a sign of infection. I generally find it pretty suspicious when your computer fires up Internet Explorer all by itself right after it boots. That can be a sign. If your computer is amazingly slow to start up and open programs, and I mean more than normal, that's another sign that you could be infected with the virus. Another good one is if some of your friends or some of your colleagues are complaining that you're spamming them with a bunch of emails. That's a good sign that something has set up an email server on your computer and might be sending out rogue emails.
So somebody in your address book, for instance, got an email from you that you thought you never sent.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
So you'll kind of figure out or ultimately get the idea that there's something wrong. You know, that may not always be the case. So if your system's acting up, there just may be some software that's not configured correctly or something wrong with memory or whatever. But chances are, you know, a good place to at least start is making sure you do a scan of your system for viruses through one of these software packages.
Viruses and spyware.
Okay.
Spyware tends to drag down a system quite a bit. I hear a lot of people blaming the death of a computer on viruses, and based on experience, very seldom does a virus actually kill your system. A virus needs your computer alive to be able to propagate, so most times a problem with boot up is actually due to a system update or some other type of software that you installed recently.
Now, some have said that a good way to protect yourself is to turn your computer off when you're not using it. Is that, you know, is that something that our listeners should be doing, or does that really not make a difference?
Well, there's some validity to it. It was a lot more. It was a lot better advice back when we did not use something called network address translation. At one time, when you were on high-speed internet, you had a number that was public. In other words, everybody on the internet could see it, and they'd constantly knock at your door. Then it was better to decrease your exposure by shutting it off. There were also a couple of Microsoft update issues where your update could be hijacked, and it was better to keep it off at that time as well. Generally, if you have a firewall, I would generally say to leave your computer on unless you're going to leave it for a long period of time or you're done working with it for the day.
Now, you mentioned firewall. What is exactly a firewall? What does it do?
Your computer has a bunch of programs on it and a bunch of subsystems, and they generally like to communicate over the internet or over your local network. What a firewall does is it basically stops these programs from talking without your permission. They can stop different types of malware from installing and basically communicating with their with the person who installed it.
So they can block incoming connections and outgoing connections?
Correct.
Okay.
A good one can. Generally, your stock firewall that comes with your operating system does not do a very good job of blocking outbound communication. That's why it's very important to actually have a third-party firewall.
So there's some that are software-based firewalls that sit on your machine, whether it be a notebook or a desktop. Are there things that are on your connection, you know, whatever you use to connect to the internet? A lot of our listeners, I'm sure, have cable modems or those kinds of things. Is there something that sits on that level that can protect you?
Sure, there are. Many of them have it built in, but it's a very basic feature set. You can get more advanced ones around $200 that really can make a difference in your security. It's generally recommended to use a hardware firewall over a software firewall because you're stopping the traffic before it ever hits your computer, which is the weakest point of your security.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What about the security of wireless networks, Rob? Am I safe being on a wireless network in my home? And what about those convenient ones at Starbucks and all those other places that they're popping up these days?
Wireless should never be considered secure, particularly public access Wi-Fi. I'd never consider conducting a financial or personal transaction over a public connection. At home, I generally recommend using WPA security. It's fairly secure and it allows you to use some friendly passwords. I'd note that WEP, which is a popular security protocol at this time, can now be considered open access. The security on it has been cracked and it can be broken in about 4 minutes. So anybody who really wants to get on and is even slightly experienced can break that. So I consider that public when you see it.
So WAP, I know, was the only protocol that was available on modems or network routers for a long time. So if you've got an older one of those, you know, Netgear, whatever it is, Linksys, those kinds of things that are sitting in your home or have been for a while, it's probably WAP, right?
It probably is. In many cases, there's a firmware update for them that will allow them to do WPA security. Not in all cases, but in many.
Okay. A lot of our home users, and I'm sure some in our schools and churches, are using wireless, so that's a great tip to make sure that that connection is as safe as it possibly can, because let's face it, the convenience of wireless is, you know, it's hard to argue with.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Rather than running wires everywhere, and as wireless technology gets better and better. You know, absolutely. You mentioned passwords. What about passwords? Are there some common things that users can do to protect themselves, even though that, you know, there's intruders, and maybe even if they do get into your system, are there, you know, just good rules of thumb about passwords that you can give us?
Well, I prefer using a passphrase versus a password. For example, instead of using my dog's name, Freddy, I use the phrase, Freddy's my favorite dog. I'd recommend using a mix of capital and lowercase letters. Substitution for letters, letters for numbers is also a good trick, like using a zero instead of the letter O, okay. Or else using three as a backwards E. Try to make your passphrase memorable so that you don't have to write it down as well, because if you're sticking your password to your monitor, it's pretty well useless.
We talked last week, Sally and I talked about a little pick of the week of the password safe, you know, tool that we use here. I find that invaluable because that allows me to create strong passwords that I could never even remember, and then use the tool, you know, to log into some of these accounts. Are different kinds of computers, by their very nature, safer than others? You often hear, well, Macs never have any viruses. Is that a true statement, and is that a reason to maybe switch to something like that?
Well, that's a rough question.
That's a whole other show.
I have some personal preferences. I work in security. I've switched my home to a Linux and Mac platform. Mm-hmm. They're more secure, but it's security by obscurity. Basically, what I'm saying is because there's less Macs and there's less Linux boxes out there, they're more secure because less people write viruses for it. They can always get a virus, and you should always be very careful and make sure to use good judgment when you're using these systems and not be reckless. But yes, they can be more secure, but they can also be more difficult to use.
And I'm sure as their popularity increases, I know that Macintoshes are becoming even more popular. There's going to be more people, you know, creating ways and creative ways, you know, to infest your system and do damage.
Yeah, certainly. In fact, I believe the Mac just experienced their first fake piece of spyware removal software mm-hmm. recently.
So it's coming.
Yeah, it's on its way.
Lots of things to be concerned with. I don't think, you know, we should try and scare our listeners into thinking that, boy, the computer is just this you know, open sewer that, you know, is an open invitation to all kinds of bad things, whether it be destructive behavior or identity theft. But there certainly are some just good, you know, a lot of it's common sense, and a lot of the tools are free. Are there websites or other resources out there that would be helpful for people to look at for these kinds of helpful hints?
Well, I generally do a lot of Googling on information on internet security. I'm a big fan of using things like Snopes to check if a email is legitimate.
Is that Snopes?
Yes.
Okay.
And
Snopes.
I believe it's .com or .org.
Okay. We'll check that out and put that in our show notes. But yeah, you'll often get I will sometimes get those kinds of emails from my mom that are forwarded from, you know, 10 other different people saying, you know, watch out for this or do that, or you know, make sure you go into your system and delete this file.
Yes, and it's often a system file.
Right. You wake up the next day and your computer's just a, you know, hunk of plastic sitting there, right?
It's pretty unfortunate, yes.
Right. Anything else you want to share with our listeners about security in general, Rob?
I did not mention any Mac freeware for antivirus, and I'd love to plug ClamXAV, which is, I think, the only widely used Mac freeware for security. A lot of Mac people run sans any antivirus, so ClamXAV would be a better choice for them than nothing.
Super. Thank you, Rob, for your time. Appreciate you being on the show, and valuable information. All the links and information that Rob shared with us, we'll put those on our show notes so that you can explore those. But I guess rule number one is just be careful. You know, there's a lot of there's a lot of good and a lot of bad out there that we just have to protect ourselves from. So, thanks, Rob.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Rob.
Good information, Sally. I think, you know, most of our users can relate to a lot of what we just talked about. There's so much that we have to be concerned with. You know, one of those things shouldn't really be whether our computer and the information on it is safe.
Right, and I'm just thinking about the church office setting and the kind of data that is housed on those church office computers, and we want to protect our church members with their private information that's housed on those computers. So we should take this very seriously.
Yeah, I get a lot of questions about should you put your church directory online and what you should put online and what you shouldn't. And really, those are the easier questions. The harder questions are how do you protect that data that's sitting on a computer that is inside your church, and is there information that you know intruders would like to get their hands on for identity theft purposes or just being malicious? So, good stuff. Rob mm-hmm. has been around the block, and it's great that he was able to share some of that with us. So, the next segment in our show is our picks of the week.
Well, mine's got an education bent to it this week. I'm going to talk about Scratch, which is a free programming language that you can use to teach kids probably from about age 8 and up computer programming skills. You can find the software at scratch.mit.edu. It was developed at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in their lifelong kindergarten group. Just from their website, I had a little blurb. It's a new programming language that makes it easy to create your own interactive stories, animations, games, music, and art. And you can share those creations over the web. They do have a lot of great resources online for you to get started, different getting started guides, reference guides, information about different functions you can do with the programming components. And so literally kids from fourth grade and up can just run with the software and develop their own interactive little programs and upload those to the web. You can also, once they're uploaded to the web, you can embed them in your own websites as well, kind of like you can use embedding code from YouTube or those type of sites to put the videos on your website. You have that kind of coding associated with your Scratch projects. Scratch comes with a whole media library with sample projects and sounds and images and backgrounds and all kinds of things like that. And the other thing that's neat about it is any Scratch project that you see that someone else has uploaded, you can automatically bring down to your Scratch program and look at their coding to figure out how they made their programs work. So, really a great tool. We used it here in Sleepy Eye, started with it this fall, and I wish you could see the electricity that went through the classroom as the kids started experimenting with the different functions they could use in Scratch. And I mean, I heard kids saying, oh, I want to work with computers when I grow up and all that kind of stuff, and it was just really exciting to see.
Yeah, sounds like a great way to introduce kids to, you know, not just using a computer but making a computer useful. And I think it stretches the mind. I think it enhances creativity, you know, and an interest in logic and math. So mm-hmm. cool tool, very nice. My pick of the week is a website, and it's kind of a website / tool that you can download called Plaxo, P-L-A-X-O. And what Plaxo does, many times, a lot of us want to synchronize information between different computers. Many of us now have multiple computers, whether we have a home computer, a work computer, or different computers around the home for the kids, or just we want to be able to access information from another location. And Plaxo is a great tool to be able to do that. I've been using it for a couple years now. Basically, it's a tool that synchronizes information between multiple computers, or what they call sync points. So if you want to synchronize your address book, calendar, notes, tasks between, you know, all kinds of tools. So let's say you've got a Hotmail account or an AOL mail account, and you want to synchronize that with your Google Mail or your Outlook account or Windows Mail or Windows Express or LinkedIn is another one, or even, you know, on the Mac as well. You set up two sync points or as many sync points as you want, and essentially you download a little component, you attach it to the program, whether it be Outlook or Google or whatever it is, and it goes out and it finds information in both resources and brings it together. So that if you update information, an address in one location, it automatically syncs it to the other location. So you're never left wondering whether you updated in all the locations that you keep that information on. There's an online website for it as well. So if you're not at your home computer, let's say you're at a relative's home or in the library or wherever, and you're on a computer that's not your own, you can go to this website. You have your entire address book there. Your calendar is available, notes, tasks, those kinds of things. Very secure. It's a secure connection. And works seamlessly. You basically install it, and you forget it, and ultimately you just have one single source for all your information. So great tool. That's Plaxo, Plaxo.com, and it's free. Yeah, that's the next best thing about it.
I think I'll check that out this afternoon, Martin. That sounds like a great tool.
Next is our Wells.net feature of the week. Sally, what do we have this week?
I have for you the Wells Locator Search. This is our tool that we have listed all Wells and ELS congregations, as well as schools and early childhood ministry, worship broadcasts, care facilities, all different organizations within Wells. And you can search the database by different location type things, you know, a zip code or that kind of thing, and come up with a list that meets your criteria. And once you find a list, you'll find contact information, service times, links to their website and email, maps, directions, all that kind of great information is included in the locator search. And it has a lot of different very useful possibilities. If you're relocating to an area and you're looking for a new church home, obviously this is a great place to start. Or if you're traveling and you want to make sure that you don't miss church on Sunday when during your traveling, you can map out your church plans as you map out the rest of your plans for your trip. One of the newest possibilities with our locator search program is the refer a friend option there. And what that allows you to do is send notification to a local pastor of someone that you know in a particular area that needs a church home so that that pastor can make contact with them. If it's a college student or someone that's just recently relocated and hasn't taken the time to find a new church, you can search for the church and then send a notification to that local pastor to make contact with them. And it's also great just for looking for contact information if you're trying to get in touch with someone across the country and you need to find the church information, then you can look here for that. And all of that information is there. It's regularly updated, I believe, on a weekly basis. So anytime a congregation reports changes to their information to the Senate offices, then that's going to flow through and show up in our locator search program as well. And you can find that actually a couple of different ways. From our Wells.net homepage, there's an icon over in the upper right area of the page to the locator search. And it's also in our top toolbar that goes along for the ride on every page of our Wells.net site. Or you can access it directly at the URL wells.locatorsearch.com.
Thanks, Sally. Great resource. I've used it many times, and especially the map feature, because you can plot your course, directly from where you are to where you want to go with a couple clicks. Mm-hmm. What do we have to tell our folks in the area of promotional items?
Well, let's see. This week we want to talk about the Witness This podcast. It's another podcast that's part of our Streams media network.
You mean we're not the only one, Sally?
No, actually, we're not even the first.
That's right.
Witness This has been around for several months. It's produced by the Wells Communication Services Office, and it's done with Director Joel Hochmuth interviewing various people about how they're using their faith in their everyday life. The most recent episode was just released, and in it, Joel Hochmuth speaks with Kathy Wendland, and she shares some of her information about serving on the Wells Central Africa Medical Mission and how her faith was witnessed in those experiences. So it's a great podcast, a good listen for you if you haven't discovered it yet. You can find it at wells.net/jump/witness this. That's the Witness This podcast.
And you can also go to the Streams site, streams.wells.net, where you'll find our podcast as well as theirs and others, all kinds of information on streams.wells.net. Mm-hmm. We've reached the community feedback section of our show. had a number of emails over the week since our last show from Gail Potratz in New London, Wisconsin. She serves on our Technology Advisory Committee. She made a great suggestion. She was wondering, for all the final web users out there, and remember, if you're a long-time listener now of three shows, we interviewed Brian Schaefer of Final Web, and he talked a little bit about that web hosting program that we have. Gail's question was, you know, could we add as a news feed, you know, to the Final website, you know, information about this show, because we do have everything in an RSS feed, and yeah, that's a great suggestion, and we'll add that so that it will just be a little drop-down box that you can add all the information for WellsTech and the WellsTech podcast. So thanks, Gail. Sally, you have something else?
Yes, we also heard from Rick Cron. He sent an email into the WellsTech listserv, and he's a pastor at Martin Luther Church in Neenah, Wisconsin, and he was asking questions about recommendations for digital audio video equipment. Their church is looking at getting camcorder equipment and also the ability to record audio only, and he's wondering if other congregations have done this recently, and if they had recommendations for the equipment purchases that they were looking for. So far no one's responded to Pastor Cron, so if you have that kind of information and want to jump out on the WellsTech listserv, we certainly would be interested in others' experience, and perhaps, Martin, we can talk about that further in one of our future shows as well.
Absolutely. We get that question quite a bit. So certainly go to the wellstech.wells.net website and click on the listserv link there, subscribe, and if you've got a response for Rick, please go ahead and do that. So thanks this week to Gail and to Rick for your questions. Appreciate your feedback. Please keep that coming. Well, Sally, we've reached the time in the show to conclude things, and you longtime listeners now will know that we conclude every show by featuring a Wells artist. We've featured Michael Schrader last week and Michael Wessendorf the week before. I think they were both Mikes, right?
Mm-hmm,
this week is
right.
Not a Mike. It's a group called Koine. Koine is the church band for St. Marcus Lutheran Church here in Milwaukee. They've been around for a number of years. They've just started to release some albums. The first album they released was in 2005. They recently released their second one called Gesangbuch. That's their second one. And if you want to know a little bit more about Koine and their music, they do perform concerts at local congregations. KoineMusic.com is where you can find out more information about them. The song that we'll be listening to is called I Hear the Savior Calling. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We'll see you next week.
I hear the Savior calling. The gospel comes to me. My eyes, once closed in blindness, are opened now to see that I myself was helpless to live eternally, but dying Christ did save me, and now he calls for me. Call me, be the From door to door I witness to share my Savior's plea. Yet nothing can be added, no word on bended knee. Beyond the simple gospel, a Savior calls for me. I hear the Savior calling, His call has urgency. Savior, this is my humble plea. Prepare.